This morning, I want to talk about a subject that goes along with the introductory stuff I was talking about last night. If you recall last night, we did introductory and background investigations. I don't know if you'd call it anything as fancy as that. But last night, I tried to make the point that there is some distance between us and the book of Job. We read the book of Job as people here in the 21st century. Some of us have lived a good chunk of the 20th century. And we come to it with certain sets of embedded expectations. And the author of Job, and indeed the characters in Job, the people in Job, they're not necessarily looking to meet those expectations. So I tried to lay out the idea that we are culturally and chronologically distant from the people who are speaking in the book of Job. And this morning, I want to talk a little bit about three problems in Job. So in the book of Job, obviously it's exploring the topic of suffering. How can a good person suffer? You've heard this before. Why do the righteous suffer? How does that happen in a just world, a just universe, governed by a good God? How do these things happen? And really, the book of Job, I'm going to tip my hand a little bit, the book of Job isn't there to answer that question. It's there to clarify the question for us. Because as believers, the answer doesn't come from down here, right? The answer doesn't come from down here. And I'm going to stop there because otherwise you won't come back Sunday morning, and that's what I'm talking about. But three problems in the book of Job. And if you would, please turn in your Bibles to Psalm 1. Psalm 1. And you'll notice that in the canon, Psalm 1 happens to come where? Right after the book of Job. Now, is that by design? I'm not going to venture out on that one, but it is a little bit ironic, because I'll just read Psalm 1 to you. How blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. He will be like a tree firmly planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither. And in whatever he does, he prospers. The wicked are not so, but they are like chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. Okay, true or false? All right, so, okay, good one. Okay, so if it's between these two things, the covers, right, the book of Table of Contents and the book of Concordance, if it's between those two things, there is truth to it, right? And it's true truth. It's God's truth. But you nailed it. You hit it right on the head. Sometimes this is the case in our experience, but sometimes it's not. And that's why there are other psalms in the Psalter. If you turn over to Psalm 88, Psalm 88 is a little bit longer psalm. But listen to this particular psalm here. Psalm 88, a psalm of the sons of Korah for the music director, according to Hebrew words that I don't know what they mean, a maskil of Heman the Ezrahite. And listen to this. O Lord, the God of my salvation, I have cried out by day and in the night before you. Let my prayer come before you. Incline your ear to my cry. For my soul has had enough troubles, and my life has drawn near to Sheol, or the grave. I am reckoned among those who go down to the pit. I have become like a man without strength, forsaken among the dead, like the slain who lie in the grave, whom you remember no more, and they are cut off from your hand. You have put me in the lowest pit, in dark places in the depths. Your wrath has rested upon me, and you have afflicted me with all your waves. You have removed my acquaintances far from me. You have made me an object of loathing to them. I am shut up and cannot go out. My eye has wasted away because of affliction. I have called upon you every day, O Lord. I have spread out my hands to you. Will you perform wonders for the dead? Will the departed spirits rise and praise you? Will your loving kindness be declared in the grave, your faithfulness in Abaddon? Will your wonders be made known in the darkness, and your righteousness in the land of forgetfulness? But I, O Lord, have cried out to you for help, and in the morning my prayer comes before you. O Lord, why do you reject my soul? Why do you hide your face from me? I was afflicted and about to die from my youth on. I suffer your terrors. I am overcome. Your burning anger has passed over me. Your terrors have destroyed me. They have surrounded me like water all day long. They have encompassed me altogether. You have removed lover and friend far from me. My acquaintances are in darkness. Okay, verse 19. But it all got better. Doesn't say that, does it? Doesn't say that. And so what we've got here are there's a difference in the book of Psalms between Psalms of orientation, right? When your needle is pointed north and your feet are pointed north, you're moving in the right direction. That's Psalm 1. And then you've got what I call the Great Gulf Fixed. And you've got psalms like Psalm 88. So Psalm 88 is a psalm of disorientation, where the psalm writer is describing a situation where his needle is not pointed to the north. He doesn't know which way his feet are pointed, and he doesn't know where he's going, and all he can do is cry out in the darkness. Normally speaking, at the end of such a psalm, or sometimes in the middle, or sometimes even at the beginning, I think it's Psalm 33, where the resolution is actually at the beginning, and then it gets darker as it goes. Really strange, right? But folks, this is what it's like to be a human being. Some days we live in Psalm 1. Some days we live in Psalm 88. And we don't know why, necessarily, we don't know why there is that difference. Why is there such a great gulf fixed in our experience? Because a lot of times, it really is. It's one or the other. Now, you don't read Psalm 1. Well, some funerals you would. But you wouldn't read this Psalm 1 at the funeral of somebody who died tragically. You wouldn't read Psalm 88 at a wedding. Okay? It would seem really odd, right? You have removed lover and friend far from me. Okay, let's. Where are the rings? That would be portentous of bad things. Okay, so, but these are legitimate within human experience. And what I want to point out is that these come later in the canon than the book of Job. Right? And this is the problem that the book of Job is addressing. It's orientation versus disorientation. This is the big issue. This is the one that they did not have tools to fix. Right? So I don't know about you, but maybe our brother here has worked on a Saab before. I know, yes, exactly. I married into a Saab, right? And you flip up the hood flips up backwards, so it flips up to the front, and it's huge. And you know, you could put like four washing machines inside the area where the hood is. This was a Saab 900 non-turbo. So the engine is about the size of the thing that makes your phone vibrate when you get a call. Right? But it's all packed up against the firewall. The fan belts are in the back. They're up against the firewall. To get to the oil filter, you have to slide your hand down in there, and you reach back, and you can kind of get your fingers on it, right? And literally, I've done this. So the transmission is in the wrong place. It still goes down the road. I don't know how, but you can actually step into the hood and stand with both feet on the ground and stand upright, and you know the engine is kind of backpacked in the corner. You've been there, haven't you?
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah, and so they're next to impossible to work on, and they're designed by people who design jets. Who would fly in a Saab jet? Not sure. But the point here is that thing will give you misery. And you compare that to my dad's 1972 Gremlin, where the oil filter's right there. Everything's right there. It's designed to be worked on by human beings. And that's maybe a terrible example, but related anyways. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the first problem. Turn in your Bibles, if you would, to Job chapter 1. Job chapter 1, I've got pages, they're a little bit small, you can't quite see them as I'd hoped, but these are pages out of Blake's woodcuts, his art. I commend these to you, and they're really good. So in Job chapter 1, I want to make the positive case for Job. So this is how you read the book of Job, right? Job chapter 1, starting in verse 1, it says, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless, upright, fearing God, turning away from evil." Okay, so right there in the first verse, this is designed to privilege you as the reader of Job into a favorable impression of Job the man. Okay, what are you supposed to take with you all the way through to chapter 42? He was an upright man. Yep. And that he feared God. Okay, so we're talking here about his ethical righteousness. He was blameless. He was upright, so there was a vertical component to his blamelessness. He feared God, and he turned away from evil. So there's the positive and the negative. He feared God, so it curtailed certain things from his life. It excluded certain means of behavior. So you could look at his life and say that he was a good neighbor, a good citizen, and he was a good, I don't know what you would call believers back then, probably God-fearers. But he was good at that too, right? So take verse 1, and I don't know how you do it. Maybe write it on your hand. That's how I would have done it in junior high. Called it my palm pilot because those hadn't been invented yet. But mark that down. Remember that as we go through, that's important. And it says, so positive case for Job, fourfold description of his character, and then you've got the fourfold description of his wealth. He was a blessed man, and he knew that. Verse 2, 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. His possessions also were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and very many servants, and that man was the greatest of all the men of the East. Now, I don't know how much of a blessing it would be to you if you've ever met a camel to have 3,000 of them, but he had servants for that, so it's one of those things where, you know, you can admire it from a distance, and you don't have to get too close, and as long as you are upwind of it, it's accounted to you as wealth. But this is how you accounted wealth in these days. So like I argued last night, this is probably around the generation of Abraham. And if you were a wealthy man, people would say, well, how many livestock do you have? How many sons and daughters do you have? What is the size and stature of your household? Right? And how many things with hooves do you've got running around? Okay, that's how you accounted wealth. And then you get down to verses 4 and 5, and it says, his sons used to go and hold a feast in the day of each one on his day, so probably their birthday, and they would send and invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. So on some kind of rotation, his seven sons would have a feast on his or her day, okay? And whatever that day is that their birthday? Is that a day of the week? Not quite sure about that, but at any rate, that's what they would do. And what is this telling us about his family? They're close. They're harmonious. Was that always the case, Jacob and Esau, in the ancient world? Okay, a lot of times a man's sons would turn into warring tribes and factions against one another, and they'd wipe each other out. That was not the case in Job's family. So here's another picture of the way in which he was blessed. And then listen to verse 5. When the days of feasting had completed their cycle, Job would send and consecrate them, rising up early in the morning and offering burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, perhaps my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus Job did continually. Now I call this section building a positive case for Job, because what are you as the privileged reader supposed to come away with from Job chapter 1, verses 1 through 5? What kind of impression of Job and his character and his state do you come away with? He's a godly man, and he has been blessed for his godliness. If there was ever a Psalm 1 guy, it's Job in Job chapter 1, verses 1 through 5.
Yeah, and when we talk about him as a God-fearer, the fact that he would intercede on behalf of his family is pretty remarkable.
Yes.
He fears God in a positive way.
In a positive sense, and he recognizes that God is holy. And where did he come up with such good theology? That's one of the mysteries of the book of Job. How did he come up with such a strong sense of the sacrificial nature of righteousness? Where did he come up with that? I mean, Edomite wisdom, yeah, great, but yes, sir. Cain and Abel, yeah. Yes. Yeah, so it's in their consciousness that this would be the case, that substitution needs to happen at some level.
It also shows that it's God who seeks out man, and not man who seeks out God.
Ooh. Yeah, and we're gonna see that theme being that's one of the limits of their knowledge, where they're butting up against something where natural theology can't take you there. That's something where God has to reach across. We can't get that far. And that's something where we'll actually see a theme like that woven into the narrative. So in the next session, when we start going through what some have described as the Great Sinai Desert, the narratives, we'll actually see one of those that as part of one of the themes that unfolds. Okay, so for right now, though, what kind of man are we dealing with? A godly man, and a man whose godliness has been rewarded, right? He is the man who is planted by the stream, okay? And he's bearing fruit in its season. Okay, this is a Psalm 1 man. Okay, so that's what we think of Job. And what did God think of Job? So it goes on, right? If the story ended there, we'd say, wow, that Job guy, he's pretty great. And we wish the story would end there, you know, just like when I'm preaching through Exodus. A couple of times when I wish the story would end. I wish it would end sometime before, you know, they fall into sin, right? I wish it would end right there. They affirmed the covenant. They had the party. The end. No, golden calf. And here, you get to verse 6. And now this is where the reader is really privileged. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it." It's a little bit of a tart answer there, just minding my own. And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job?" So what does God think of Job? "What have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil." Now, had Satan considered Job? Doesn't appear that he has. And so if you really want to think about who started the book of Job, who started all this? God did. God swung his spotlight on Job and said, "Satan, take a look at that." Right? So that's what God thought of Job. Now, the blue oval is Second Commandment violations. For those of you with sensitivities to that, I omitted a couple yesterday. Forgive me if you are sensitive to these things. And Satan really does. Here's what Satan does. Satan poses the first problem. Okay, Job's integrity is untested. Because Job has been living this Psalm 1 life, yeah, there were probably days when he couldn't get his camel started. You know, we've all had that day. I want to ride to town. Well, that camel's dead. He's not going to, well, I'll have to get another. Well, they're out on the field. Ah, my life is over. You felt that way. Got to get to work. But here's the thing. Satan poses the first problem. Does Job fear God for nothing? And he actually asks that question. You look down in verse 9. Then Satan answered the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Verse 10. "Have you not made a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But put forth your hand now and touch all that he has," Satan says to God. "He will surely curse you to your face." And verse 12, then the Lord said to Satan, basically this, "I'm not going to do it, you do it." Right? He says, "Behold, all that he has in your power, only do not put forth your hand on him." So Satan departed from the presence of the Lord, and we know what happened. And here's the point. What is Satan doing here? He has identified the first problem, the problem of untested integrity. Right? Job seems like this guy who is blessed, and Satan says, "It's because you've put a force field around him. Lift that force field. And God, you go and destroy all this stuff, and then see what happens. Okay, so if God were to do it, right? And you guys, if you've had kids, you know how this works. If God were to do it, and Job passes, like we know he does. If Job passes, then what? Then God said, "Well, you didn't do it enough." So what does God do? God says, "You do it. Make sure that this is a true trial. Only don't touch him." Right? So.
You almost wonder, though, if we go back to Genesis, right?
Yeah.
Satan thinks, "Yeah, this is, I'm going to win this," right? because he won already. You know, he won that battle in the garden, right? Man fell.
Essentially, yeah.
And it's basically the same thing. It's a test of man's integrity. And you wonder if in the back of his mind he's thinking, "I got this.
I've been here before." Yes. Yeah. Well, he knew enough about human nature to know that, I mean, at least by his experience, that if you attack somebody's wealth, what happens? Right? You uproot somebody who's the tree planted by the stream, and you uproot that, you know, human nature typically is fickle that way, where people will curse God and die, like Job's wife says. So he knows that much about that and human nature. Now it's interesting though that there are several who need to wrestle with this particular question: does Job fear God for nothing? Okay. Satan needs to wrestle with this question, doesn't he? Because he has seen this in his experience, which probably was kind of extensive. He's probably seen a lot of people. You touch their stuff and their faith goes kablooey. Job needs to wrestle with this question because he is the tree planted by the stream. What happens when that stream dries up? What happens when the tree is uprooted? Everyone in the story needs to wrestle with this question. It hasn't been broached yet, right? The reader needs to wrestle with this question. Do I fear God for nothing? So right here, you've got this privileged view of the archetypical righteous man. And now he's going to go through this suffering. And it's interesting that Satan becomes this instrument by which we reach toward the first step in the solution. And unwittingly, I'm sure it was unwittingly. But Satan really is the foil in the story, right? He comes along and he asks the perennial question, does Job fear God for nothing? And it's by him as an instrument that God orchestrates everything else. Okay. And you see here a picture. William Blake does such a good job of capturing the pathos. And probably from back there, you don't really see it. So I commend it to you for your perusal at another time, I guess. So here's part one of Toward a Solution. We need to test Job's integrity. Does he fear God for nothing? That's a great question. And you look back at the text again. And we'll just read through this. Verse 10, have you not made a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands and his possessions have increased in the land, but put forth your hand now and touch all that he has. He will surely curse you to your face. It's the voice of experience talking here. Verse 12, then the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power, only do not put forth your hand on him. So Satan departed from the presence of the Lord. Then you get down into verse 13. Now on the day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job. So that's just putting it on the calendar for us, okay? Verse 14, a messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans attacked and took them. They also slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone am escaped to tell you. Okay? So Sabaeans came along, and they killed his servants and took his animals. Then it goes on, and it says, while he was still speaking. So you can imagine there's this line of servants, and they're all arriving at once. While he was still speaking, another also came and said, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Then verse 17. While he was still speaking, another also came and said, the Chaldeans formed three bands and made a raid on the camels and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Then verse 18, while he was still speaking, another also came and said, your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And behold, a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they died. And I alone have escaped to tell you. So now what does he have? He has four servants, right? Four servants who are all standing there looking at each other, wondering what's going on, looking at their master, Job. And he is receiving all of this information within the span of minutes. Okay? Now, how do you test somebody's integrity better than that? We've already talked about how their family was close. And so Satan really did save the worst for last. Their family was close. He was a wealthy man. He's not a wealthy man anymore. And so out of his very many servants, now he's got four. And he probably, because all of his other wealth is essentially gone, he has no means of sustaining those four servants anymore. And, I don't want to spend too much time here, but let this percolate a little bit. Let this do what it's designed to do. Remember who this is happening to. This is the Psalm 1 man. His stream dried up. He has been hewn down at the roots. Right? Does Job fear God for nothing? Well, here's how you find out. And so testing Job's integrity, you look down in verses 20 through 22. Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshipped. I just want to pause on verse 20 for just a second. So, within the course of, maybe 3 or 4 minutes, he gets the four reports. And he musters his strength, he rises up from the ground. Okay? That alone seems superhuman at this point. That alone seems like that's beyond normal human capability. After receiving a report like this, he tore his robe, which was an ancient Near Eastern expression of grief, very appropriate for the circumstance. Then he had to go and find a razor, probably a mirror of some sort, and he shaved his head. Now you think about, all of this would have taken a little bit of time. He would have had a minimal amount of time, but a not insignificant amount of time to process this. Look what he says next. Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. That is remarkable. That is remarkable. Now, again, we wish that the book ended here, don't we? We wish that the book ended right here. And we say, that's what it looks like to be patient in the midst of suffering. But it goes on. Yes, sir. Well, he didn't have leprosy.
Yeah, I don't know if it was something that was associated in the culture with.
I think that honestly, here's what I think. I think that the donation goes the other way. That Moses is incorporating things that would have been prominent in the ancient Near East, along with some brand new stuff, right? Like the priesthood, the priestly garments, things like that. But when Moses writes the law, God gave the people of Israel things that would have been familiar. He doesn't ask them to build a satellite, launch it into space, and broadcast things. Why? Because that's completely out of their orbit. Get the pun. He doesn't say anything about time machines or robots. He uses idioms that they would have been familiar with. And I think that that people in the ancient Near East, they knew things like that. Now, had they inherited it from, you know, from the godly line of Seth, I happen to think that a lot of the good raw material that still existed, like, you know, shaving his head as a sign of mourning. Okay? Now, we don't do that, but they did. And to them, that would have been an appropriate sign of mourning.
Yeah, one of the cross-references just in the Bible that I'm using right here, Jeremiah 7:29. Cut off your hair and cast it away. Raise a lamentation on the heights.
Yes.
So that it was a sign predominantly of grief, not of ceremonial cleansing.
Yeah, yeah. And you see that, you know, like Paul with his oath, he had to cut his hair off and things like that. But yeah, so disfiguring yourself, I guess, is probably what it amounts to. So he passes the test, and I have a cross reference here. If you look at Job 30, verse 24. And I'm not sure exactly why I have this particular cross reference. Oh, Job 30, starting in verse 24. This is Job lamenting later on. Yeah, I remember now. It says, "Yet does one not in a heap of ruins stretch out his hand, or in his disaster therefore cry out for help? Have I not wept for the one whose life is hard? Was not my soul grieved for the needy? When I expected good, evil came. Then I waited for light, then darkness came. I am seething within, and I cannot relax. Days of affliction confront me. I go about mourning without comfort. I stand up in the assembly and cry for help. I have become a brother to jackals and a companion of ostriches," and so forth. We talk about how remarkable it is, back in Job chapter 1, verse 22, through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. Okay? Now, did he complain? You know, we have a little bit of an allergy toward the word complain, because if you complain, that means you're not satisfied with what God is doing in your life, and etc. But there is a godly there is a way that godly people can complain, right? And it's really about where your feet are pointed. If you're complaining to God, that's one thing. If you're complaining against God and your feet are pointed out the door, that's something else. So there's this orientation, right? And yes, Job did complain. And that's why chapter 30 was there. I remember now. But that Job did indeed complain. And you don't get too far in the Psalms before you see people complaining. Right? And don't ever let somebody tell you that Christians can't complain or it's some deadly sin. Otherwise, you're throwing Asaph under the bus. Every time he asks, "How long, O Lord?" you're supposed to roll your eyes and say, "Come on, Asaph. You know, put a little joy in your heart. Turn that frown upside down," you know. What's Job supposed to do? I mean, he says the right thing here in chapter 1, verse 21. And he's showing you where his feet are pointed. He's showing you his orientation. That's not the only thing that comes out of his mouth. That's important. Because you're going to have to shave your head and sit on the ash heap at some point. What's going to come out of your mouth? So let's not second guess this. That's what liberals do, okay? So don't second guess Job's integrity here, and don't say that later on he gives up on that integrity and he walks away. I can't tell you how sick it makes me to read people say that, you know, godly people can't mourn on the ash heap. It's like, you've never gone through anything. Okay, so now we come to the second problem, and chapter 2 goes on describe how Satan comes again and tests Job by cursing his health. So it's one thing if all your stuff is gone and now you've got these sores all over your body, and the only relief that you can get is by sitting on an ash heap, where maybe the ashes, you know, will be soothing somehow. I don't know. Or maybe that's just another sign of mourning. I've read both ways and I haven't taken a position. But there he is on an ash heap, which is not a nice place to sit for normal human beings, scraping himself with a piece of pottery for relief. Can't afford a doctor anymore. So what do you do? And so that's when his friends come to him. So here we are in verse 9 of chapter 2. This is a trial all unto itself. Then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." Now, she may have been saying that mercifully, right? "Job, I can't bear to watch you suffer." There may have been an element of mercy in that, but listen to the way that Job rebukes her, verse 10. But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity or calamity?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Okay, so has Job passed the integrity test? So, yeah, yep, yes, sir.
Excuse me, one second.
Not a problem.
With this particular part where it goes to his wife, wife's talking to him, you also have to remember his wife is going through the exact same thing that Job is.
Yes.
In the sense that, not physically, but she's lost everything. She's lost her position, she's lost all her 10 kids.
Yes. Yes.
And sometimes I think we forget that, you know, she's suffering too, and she responds. They kind of think there should be some sympathy toward her too.
Yes.
Die. Look what's happened here.
There are 10 fresh graves on the hill,
right.
and all hope of their nest egg is with the Sabaeans. Yeah, that is such an excellent point. They are co-sufferers. They are co-sufferers, but that's something that the lens of the author is trained on Job, because he is, well, I mean, he's the patriarch of the family. So he's, you know, he is suffering representatively. And it's not as though we don't harden our heart towards Job's wife. And that's why I say that there's an element of sympathy in what she says here. You know, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. Be done with this suffering." I think that she's, you know, she's suffering on her own, right? She's disorientated. She's in the midst of Psalm 88 right now. And so what she's saying to Job is now she's seeing Job's health tanking very visibly. She says, "Job, this is too much. This is too much. It would be a mercy for you to go to your grave." But that is an excellent point. That is an excellent point.
There's a connection between Satan telling God that you do this and she'll curse him, and his wife saying the same thing that Satan said, to curse God.
Only that maybe it's working on her. Maybe it's working.
It seems like Satan had some way of influencing her to bring that up.
Yeah, I tend to be a little bit more sympathetic with her, but that's a very popular interpretation for a reason, because she's essentially agreeing with Satan. So I think maybe the better way to understand it is not that there would be a spectrum there, and I think that you'd be over here. I think I would be a little bit more over here. Over here is that she's possessed by Satan, right? I don't think that's the case. Has Satan influenced her sufficiently that she's saying this? Yes. But how much of that is satanic, and how much of it is yeah, or foolishness? And not that she's a fool. She's married to a wise man, and so she's probably. I believe that Job chose well when he chose his wife, right? Think that she's a wise woman, but in the midst of her despair, she's talking uncharacteristically like one of the foolish women. And so I think that what Satan had done had, if you want to put it this way, it had worked on her. I think that his rebuke to her would have been redemptive. I think that she's on board for the rest of the book. We don't hear about her again. Yes, absolutely. That was a loving thing to say to her. In this household, we value wisdom. So when I say this, I'm not saying this lightly, and I'm not saying it to disparage you, but you're talking like one of the foolish women. And almost like it's a discussion they'd had before, shall we accept good from God and not adversity? Right? Yeah, exactly. So I do need to get through two more problems, and I've got 7 minutes, so I'm going to stampede now. Remember? Yeah, right. So the second problem really is untested theology. So now his verse 11, I don't want to breeze past this because this is important as well. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, they came each from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Namathite. I argued last night that those are places in Edom. And they made an appointment to gather together to come to sympathize with him and comfort him. So there's some coordination here. And verse 12, when they lifted up their eyes at a distance and did not recognize him, they raised their voices and wept. And each of them tore his robe and threw dust over their heads towards the sky. Now those are boilerplate senses of deep mourning, right? Those are standard emblems of mourning. And here's one that's not. Verse 13, then they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights with no one speaking a word to him, for they saw that his pain was very great. And another thing that I get tired of, in addition to saying, well, Job lost his faith, is people who say that these were not good friends. The author does not leave that open as a possibility. Did they say some jerkish things? Oh yeah, we'll talk about some of the jerkish things they say. Have you ever had a friend who said a jerkish thing? A good friend. Have you ever had a friend chew you out? If you haven't, I don't know how well your friendships work, right? If your friendship isn't strong enough for somebody to come from miles away to listen to your pain and then chew you out, your friendships, you know, then we need to talk about friendship. This is what friendship is all about, folks. They made the investment, but that also leads to the second problem, and that is untested theology. So that's where the dialogues come in, and, you know, like I say, I don't need to spend time here because I will spend time here. The dialogues, and that leads to the second problem. What did you do, Job? Because that's one of the first things that they're interested in. After Job laments, his friends say, you know, well, so Job, what'd you do? Because they're thinking Psalm 1, right? You were the tree planted by the stream. Why'd your stream dry up and why are you chopped down and laying in the dust? What did you do? And Job is saying too, what have I done, right? Their theology is yet untested. And the instrument for working through this is Job's three friends, right? They are the instrument in God's hands. Satan has left the scene, and now Job's three friends, are they instruments of Satan? I don't think so, but they are now the foil by which God is going to prove that Job's theology is deficient. So Job begins by cursing his life. He ends by proclaiming his innocence, and his friends simply can't comprehend it. Neither can Job. Nobody can understand what's going on here. And we'll conclude by looking at the third problem, and this is what I'll be preaching on Sunday morning. Third problem, the inscrutable God. Now, I'll be talking a little bit about the book of Job doesn't provide the answer. It clarifies the question. God is really inscrutable, and you know, and he takes pains to tell Job in Job's language, I am not able to be understood by you. And that's a problem, isn't it? We want to serve God. The first and greatest commandment. What is the first and greatest commandment? You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. How do you do that when you don't understand Him? What's the first thing they tell you in marital counseling? Got to understand each other. If you want to love each other, you got to understand each other. And God here says, I can't be understood. That's just not fair, right? And actually talk about this. So the inconclusive conclusion, Elihu argues better than the three friends. Yeah, God speaks from the whirlwind. Great. Brings it all to a shimmering conclusion, except that no two commentaries that I read, no two literary treatments that I read, come away with the same conclusion. And that teaches us something. The book of Job is not about conclusions. Job had the right conclusion, didn't he? Job came away with the right answer. And we want to ask Job, what was it? He doesn't tell us. And so God comes away as this inscrutably good and powerful being, and we're not really one step closer in figuring Him out, but it certainly sharpens the questions for us. So God speaks from the whirlwind, and here's the third problem, right? The third problem is, where were you when God laid the foundations of the earth? What do you mean, where was I? My foundation wasn't laid yet. Mine wasn't laid until 1975. And a lot of you are thinking, 1975? You know, I was already hard at work by then. And here's a question. To whom is this comforting? God asks you, where were you? And you say, amen. That's not how we respond to that. It's off-putting, isn't it? And so this really is the third problem. So there's the problem of human integrity being tied to material blessings. There's the problem of our theology has limits. And then there's the problem of God Himself is really hard to understand. These are the three problems in Job. And we just, you know, Job repents. I'll talk about this later this afternoon. How many here have ever repented when you hear a story about dinosaurs? Because that's what Job chapter 41 is. God tells him about dinosaurs. And Job repents. It doesn't make sense to us. It made sense to Job. That's the point. God restores his fortune. Wouldn't the story be even better? It's like he's this righteous sufferer. He went to his grave a pauper. God restores his fortune. The mysterious character of this. Now, and then we ask the question, I ask this tongue-in-cheek, why is there so much confusion about the book of Job? And I'll answer it as somebody who spent a year preaching through it and the last 4 months reading stuff about it. Do you know what comes more clear is that I need answers to these questions for myself. Because when I read a story about dinosaurs, it doesn't lead me to repentance. So I need to look for those answers somewhere else. And so once again, why did all of this happen? Because it doesn't give us the answers. It gives us the right questions. So as we go through the poetry sections today and the dialogues, and we get all the way to the end where God speaks from the whirlwind, that's what we're looking for. We're looking for the questions. Okay, so I can maybe field one more question, comment, and then we'll break and eat up the rest of the donuts and drink up the rest of the coffee. Yes, ma'am.
So you mean by this, it gives us the questions to ask, so that that would drive us to seek the answers?
Yes, yes. And I'll tip my hand. I mean, basically what it's telling us to do is to seek in his revelation what he has revealed to us for answers to our questions, because these are three very important questions for believers, especially if we want to be thoughtful about our faith. And what it does is it drives us to things that God has revealed about himself to be true. Now, For Job, it was dinosaurs. I don't know why it was dinosaurs, but that's where it clicked for him, right? God made these amazing animals, and he plays with them and stuff, and that's how powerful and creative and whatnot he is. And for that, it clicked for Job. And you know, maybe for somebody here, it's God's unfailing love for the nation of Israel, as Paul describes it in Romans chapters 9 through 11. It could be just about anything. It could be Psalm 51 and the beauty of David's repentance. I don't know how God is going to get it across to you, but these are the questions that we're pursuing. So, good observation.